The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
The Golden State Warriors take it wire to wire to win 4-1 against the Dallas Mavericks. A 14-0 Mavs run late in the third made things slightly interesting, but they never got it lower than 9 in the end, and thus concludes a series that Golden State really controlled quite well in a way that I didn't think they would be able to do, but it was clear that the Mavs largely had no answers for Golden State. We thought maybe they'd found something with this switching. That didn't turn out to be the case at all. They executed that very poorly and couldn't keep guys in front of them, as was the case all series. And so Golden State is now back in the NBA Finals. You and I were not together for this one. You were in the arena. I was doing playback from home. But what were your takeaways being there?
Well, first off, this is the Warriors' sixth NBA Finals appearance in the last 8 years, which is truly incredible. And I will admit pretty openly that when Kevin Durant left the Warriors, I've been closest geographically while covering the entire league to the Warriors since 2009, and just thought, okay, that phase of my being able to go to finals games and all that is over. And not necessarily solely because of Durant leaving, but Klay Thompson's first injury, much less the second injury, which happened a year later. And whether we're talking about those players all getting back to not peak of their powers, but very, very high levels overall, and the support from some of the young guys, Kevon Looney had a big series, and also cultivating minimum salary guys. We'll talk about Bielitsa's impact on this one, Otto Porter overall in the season. And it is an achievement. And it is fair to say that the Warriors' record, net rating, all that fun stuff the last 2 years is not reflective of their overall team quality, and there are obvious reasons for that. But it is worth taking a beat to appreciate that, because it doesn't happen every time a team is around the mountaintop for such a long time and then comes off. They don't usually make their way back.
Certainly not. And Klay Thompson now is 6 for his last 6 in terms of seasons that he's been healthy at the end, going to the NBA Finals. And I tweeted as they were getting blown out in game 4 of the 2019 Finals without KD to go down 3-1, dynasty over. The assumption at that point was that Kevin Durant was going to leave, and for a while it looked like that was quite prescient. My other thought was, even if KD does leave, they have no way to improve this team. They had just drafted Jacob Evans, who couldn't even play for them. They're playing Alphonso McKinney and Quinn Cook. Andre Iguodala would soon leave the team, and you just felt like, yeah, they might have Steph, Klay, and Draymond, and then of course Klay got injured, but how are they going to build up around these guys at this point? Even if KD leaves, they'll be limited to the taxpayer mid-level for years to come. Instead, they made a move that you and I really pan, which was getting D'Angelo Russell. They gave up a first-round pick to move Andre Iguodala to even be able to get below the apron to receive Russell in a sign-and-trade for KD. They gave up another first for that, although it turned into a second when they had that terrible 19-20 season. But that salary slot ended up allowing them to trade for Andrew Wiggins. Another trade that I could see the point of potentially, but I felt like in the service of trading for a star, Russell would be more useful than Andrew Wiggins. And as it turned out, they never traded for a star. You thought getting that fourth star in.
Well, when they got other assets, like they got, right, they added more to the war chest than we expected and still never did.
Right. That's exactly correct. You know, they had the number 2 overall pick that became James Wiseman. And that's the craziest thing, is that they totally blew that pick, and they're still back here, and they're still back here because they traded for Andrew Wiggins, who was invaluable in this series guarding Luka Doncic, and also still being able to make him work on the other end in a way that defensive specialists that he could hide out on in previous series were not able to do. And then Jordan Poole, who they drafted with that pick in 2019 after they had made the NBA Finals, looked like maybe the worst player in the league during his rookie year, came back and was very good by the end of last year and developed into a scintillating scorer at times by the end of this season. And to have that third guy who could be a you can't leave him type of guy on the perimeter, but also be able to attack the basket and pass, and you know, his defense still could use some help, but nonetheless, he's been a huge player for them as well. So I really just give a ton of credit. And then you mentioned some of the smaller finds that they had as well, draft picks that they had in the organization, and then of course Klay Thompson for getting back from his injuries. Draymond has maintained more of his value over the three seasons after 2019 than I would have expected, and so is Steph. And so now they're back in the NBA Finals as a result.
I also thought that Game 5 was an encapsulation of that journey. I mean, Klay Thompson had some huge stretches offensively, ended up being the game's leading scorer, even over Luka with his big second half. 32 points, 12 of 25 from the field, 8 of 16 from 3. And Klay Thompson, you know that the 25 field goals is also shooting possessions because he doesn't get to the free throw line. And he definitely had plenty of defensive mistakes during this game. Like it was a rough defensive series for Klay, and he wasn't being asked to do as much, which may have been part of the problem.
Yeah. I will say that his on-ball defense ended up being pretty good. Like, they didn't
He figured out Luka a lot better towards the end of the series, and it was more just, and some of it was scheme. The Warriors were doing a lot of kind of helping middle and then giving up the pass that Luka loves to throw to the opposite corner, and so how much of that is on Kerr and Mike Brown and the coaching staff, and how much of it is on Klay Thompson and various other guys who are just running away from the weak side corner. It's unclear at this moment in time. But so Klay had stepped up. Kevon Looney had so much better of a series than I anticipated. I thought that part of the reason why I picked the Dallas Mavericks incorrectly in this series was that I thought Kevon Looney was not going to have a place to be, and was going to put pressure on the rest of the rotation, particularly with...
And as it turned out, his place to be was the offensive glass.
Right. Kevon Looney overall in the series averaged 10.6 points and 10.6 rebounds, but that included an 18 spot in Game 5, and he provided some huge offensive rebounds. He also, yet again, did a very good job, not only on Luka Doncic, but there was one possession where I was super impressed with how he handled Jalen Brunson. He kind of followed him around and ended up staying with Brunson on a drive, and so Looney stepped up and played a huge role, and I mean, we could go through the others, but Looney deserves some separate attention.
I agree. I mean, some of the offensive rebounds that he was getting, his hands are just so sticky. It's crazy how he just seems to come up with the ball. He's not really like an unbelievable positional rebounder. It's just if the ball is within his radius, he just gets it. It's incredible how he's able to, even loose ball rebounds out by the free throw line, he's able to grab away from guards who are usually quicker to those plays. And Looney even has improved it at age 26. His work with the Warriors coaching staff this year to get better as a finisher, I think, has really paid off as well. He's just more confident, and the Mavs didn't have an amazing shot blocking presence. Yeah, what did you make of Kerr going with Bielitsa, who he liked at the end of Game 4, and he was actually a key figure in this one?
It made intuitive sense in a way that, like, I got wrong on Kevon Looney, and so it kind of made sense for Bielitsa, which is that if a player's biggest weakness defensively is their lack of foot speed and they're pretty savvy, Luka is not the most damaging matchup. And we saw Bielitsa sometimes when he had to defend other guys in space and everything else, he didn't do a great job. But the other thing that I thought he did pretty well on Luka overall. But the other thing that Bielitsa fits in so seamlessly with the Warriors is that he keeps the ball moving. He's a credible enough shooter that generally teams are going to help completely off him, but he's also an adept passer. And so that I thought was a central part of why the Warriors offense succeeded in the fourth quarter of Game 4. And to an extent, that carried over. I thought that playing him alongside Looney, there were some minutes there. He played with Draymond a little bit, and it worked I understood the theory of it, especially with, I mean, it was this argument about like Kuminga. I was listening to the chat. I can't remember which broadcast, whether it was radio or something, about like, did Kuminga earn minutes for game five based on how he played game four? And I'm like, no, not particularly. I thought he did fine, but it wasn't like a dominant Kuminga performance. And so when you're looking for where to start in dealing with Otto Porter's absence, that was a reasonable way to go. I thought he did better in those minutes, the Porter replacement minutes, than
they even played him at the four.
Right.
You mentioned replaced it. He played him next to Looney. I mean, he'd played some next to Draymond, although I really kind of thought of him as more as the center there. But next to Looney, he definitely is the foreman.
Exactly. And so I thought that Bielitsa did a nice job functioning within the team concept defensively, didn't get attacked too much, and competed on the offensive glass, got a couple rebounds, kept the ball moving. And I thought that Kerr kind of he leaned a little bit too heavily to me on Bielitsa, partially because of Draymond Green's foul trouble late in the game. And kind of I thought he should have gone back to Draymond earlier, but the game wasn't close enough that I think Kerr was particularly freaked out. We saw that also with he didn't bring Steph back immediately either. And so Bielitsa can function within that place. And we've seen the Warriors over the years do well with big men who can make good decisions. And David West, I think, is a good example. David West and Bielitsa are not the same player at all, but they do have that in common. And I thought that it made the offense flow better at times. And the Warriors also are still kind of looking for answers in the minutes when Steph Curry's off the floor. And one of the ways they did it earlier in the season, as they were looking for answers, was have more passers, have more decision makers on the floor. Iguodala functioned in that, and Bielitsa's a worse defensive player than Iguodala by leaps and bounds, but it makes some sense to kind of use him in that role as well.
Yeah, and that really was the period when the game got broken open, when Steph and Luka were out in the first half, and that's when Klay Thompson really got going. And I thought at that point, the Mavs really were kind of sunk. I mean, they started off putting two on the ball on Steph, and then they tried to do some switching once Kleba came in, and that was working okay in the first quarter, but then it really fell apart once Klay started getting open. The Warriors were just, they had some time to really think about how the Mavs were going to guard them. They broke out all the old tricks like screening your own man when you know they're switching, and getting out in transition as well. Did you happen to check the transition numbers for this game, by the way? Because at one point, I think this was late in the third, the Warriors didn't have very many transitions. I think they had like 75 possessions, and they had a pretty low transition rate. It was only like 12, 13%. They had a 250 offensive rating in transition.
Yeah, they ended up at 212, it looks like.
Yeah, compared, and so that was, and it seemed like every single time Luka Doncic missed a shot in the paint, he was 1 of 7 in the paint in the first half, they would come down, he would complain to the referees, and they would get a wide open three that culminated in Draymond's behind the back pass to Klay after Luka missed a scoop shot. Oh, it is that time again, wedding season. Indochino's custom suits will have you walking into a wedding looking like $1 million, feeling like $1 million, because their suits are custom made to fit you perfectly. You can get a tailored fit from the comfort of your home. You can set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website, choose customizations without even leaving the house. Indochino was the official outfitter of my wedding. I got a tux from them. All my groomsmen got custom fitted sport jackets, and I'd like to think we all look great. Order your custom suit now. Be ready for wedding season, whether it's at home or in person at a showroom New Year, which I actually recommend. That's what I did. An Indochino style guide can walk you through all of the amazing customizations that they have. The lapels, the lining, single-breasted, double-breasted. You can feel the fabrics in person. That's definitely the best way to do it, in my opinion. But you can also do it from home as well. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com. Use that familiar cap space code to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com. I-N-D-O-C-H-I-N-O. Indochino.com. Don't forget that cap space code to let them know you came from us. And also, the Warriors' defense was very good in the first half, defending the rim without fouling. I do think the Mavs just missed some makeable shots around the rim.
The refs also weren't calling contact around the basket. I can't remember. I always think of this being a Seth Partner thing, but I can't remember for sure. Like in the very beginning of the season, it was very weird that the officials were calling all sorts of contact on the perimeter and then they weren't calling anything around the basket kind of broadly as we watched the league. And it shifted a little bit in the third quarter and then the parts of the fourth quarter. But generally, I thought that was the way this game was called. They were letting a lot go around the basket. But also Dallas, as you mentioned, was missing shots that you would expect them to normally make. And we can't do the exact like restricted area numbers because of how the scoring, how the shot marking is at Chase Center. But Dallas overall in the game, 16 of 35 on shots in the paint.
Yeah, and Dallas did keep it close some by hitting their threes. Dinwiddie was fantastic with 5 of 7. And they finished up 17 of 42, actually outshot the Warriors in the end. The Warriors kind of went cold from three in the second half, other than Clay, who for the whole game was 8 of 16 with 32 points. I thought the key moment of the game, Mavs get it down to 8. Luka misses a free throw that could have cut it to 7. And then Jordan Poole blows into the lane, finishes a layup. Mavs don't score at the end of the quarter. And then the first two possessions, so it's 10. First two possessions of the fourth quarter, Klay Thompson coming off of screens. The Mavs don't really know what they're doing. They're going to switch. Are they going to double team him coming off those screens? Klay immediately gets off the ball and they got a couple of easy buckets going to the rim. First, they moved the ball around and Wiggins got a dunk along the baseline. And then Draymond got an and one and pushed it back to 14. It was never in doubt again. By the way, Draymond Green, 17 points on 9 shooting possessions and 9 assists, only 3 turnovers.
Made all 4 of his free throws.
Yeah, wrist injury too.
And didn't throw the ball over the gym.
Yeah. I mean, that was the Warriors only 10 turnovers again. I mean, and
right. And yeah. That was like, we kind of went in the direction of macro instead of micro at the beginning, but I brought this up after game 3. If the Warriors beat you in the possession game, it is very hard to defeat them. And in this one, the turnover margin was pretty close. It was 7-10 and they had the same number of live ball turnovers, 6 respectively. And then the Warriors had that 14-6 advantage on the offensive glass, if you want it, with the percentage of misses. Golden State grabbed 35% of their misses, and Dallas had 16%. So the overall kind of opportunity game, if you want to do it this way, the Warriors had 9 fewer free throws, but they had 6 more shot attempts overall in the game. And I mean, it's hard to come back from that against a team this talented. And Dallas outshot them from 3 in terms of makes and attempts and percentage and got up more free throws, but it wasn't nearly enough.
Now, it looked like things could go awry for Golden State, and the stakes of the game increased even more when Steph Curry, on a non-contact play trying to hedge on Luka Doncic, sprained his right ankle. It didn't look too bad. It seemed clear he could stay in the game, but also particularly in the first half, he looked pretty tentative, trying to drive the ball and was driving, looking to pass a little bit more. He got blocked from behind by Kleba in one play. So he definitely was not quite 100%. His 2-point shooting, which had been awesome in the series, ended up only 3 out of 10. A couple of those were attempts to draw the foul, which were not granted to his frustration. But still, he was able to get pretty good penetration against the switch because they're just pressing up on him so much. He's able to just get the initial advantage on Kleba and then make a pass. He did it. This was maybe Steph's best passing series that we've seen. He had 9 assists, only 2 turnovers in this one. Remember, he had 11 assists in game 3. He won the first ever Magic Johnson Award as MVP of the Western Conference Finals. That's an interesting question, actually, Danny. And I'd like to record it now while it's fresh in our mind. Who do you think played better in this series, Steph Curry or Luka Doncic?
Especially when you consider the defensive part of it, I think Steph did. And he's a different kind of engine than Luka, but that, especially there were some earlier games in the series where him breaking the paint opened everything up for the whole team. It is. And I mean, Luka in this one, he had a huge third quarter, as we'll get to, but he had a really rough first half. Not that that's representative of the series, but I thought Steph was better.
I think that's true because Luka was a pretty big negative on defense, really, other than in game 4. I thought he really struggled. And part of that's just because of how the team is built, but part of that's also the team has to be built that way because of him. And especially if you're going to switch, or if you've got this great shooting on Golden State where the bigs have to be out on the floor. Luka as the four is the secondary rim protector, and he had some early help at times in game four, but overall was pretty poor on that, and they're not getting back on defense quite a bit, and he wasn't targeted like directly as in game two of that Sun series. But by the end of this game, again, they left him in the whole second half, which I thought was a mistake because he was going to run out of gas more on defense than on offense. And they had success with the non-Luka groups throughout the series, other than in this game in the start of the second. And so they had to go to switch double, and then the Warriors basically were able to score whenever they wanted to. And he wasn't really that great on the defensive glass for a lot of the series either. And just to compare his defense to Stephen Curry's defense, where Stephen Curry, I thought, had a couple of really good defensive games, like game one, and had some pretty memorable defensive plays. Like the play, I don't know if you probably actually got a great look at this live in the fourth quarter, right after he came back in, where he runs a guy off the line on the left wing with 4 seconds left on the shot clock, and then completed the possession by blocking Dorian Finney-Smith's three-pointer in the opposite corner less than 4 seconds later.
Yeah, that was really impressive.
And yeah, Steph just sets the tone. He doesn't get tired. He doesn't complain too much. Or if he does, he does it while he's getting back or while his teammates are getting the offensive rebound. So yeah, I would say, particularly when you consider, too, the way that they operate is a little bit different. Although, did Steph have more assists than Luka in this series? I bet you he might have.
He did. Curry averaged 7.4 per game and Luka Doncic averaged 6 per game.
And then you throw in the gravity, the amount of double teams that he created, the off-ball movement. Yeah, I would say Steph Curry is better than Luka. Next year, when you do our top 10 players in the NBA, we're going to be another year in and Luka will have gotten better and Steph probably will have gotten worse. But I thought just for this series, I think Steph Curry was better than Luka. And Luka had two, what I would say, pretty bad games. He was okay in the second half in this one and for a short time as he brought him back in that 14-0 run. But he was a big reason why the Mavs just couldn't get any stops in this series. So,
well, and something we saw, I thought it was a big stretch of the game when the Warriors went to the three guard configuration with Curry, Klay Thompson, and Jordan Poole all in the four together. Luka, like Ja Morant in the previous round, had to defend somebody at some stretches that was more aggressive, that was more capable with the ball in their hands. And he really, really struggled in those moments. And I thought those were some of the more challenging defensive possessions for Luka. And he's going to have to get better because there are teams with multiple threats. There isn't always a place to hide, you know, a low usage perimeter player to go for. And Luka has the positional size. He does have an incredible workload, but he has the positional size to kind of follow the Steph Curry model. And if you're not a sieve and you're, you know, like average or slightly above average for your position and for your size, it makes a world of difference for your team defense.
Yeah, I think that's about all I've got in this game.
Oh, I have a couple more things.
Please.
Spencer Dinwiddie, last minute champion. Like he made 4 3-pointers in the final minute of the first and second quarters combined. It was incredible because, like, I mean, you look at those margins and it's like the Warriors outscored the Mavericks by 5 in the first quarter and they outscored them by 12 in the second. It could have been a lot worse. And Dinwiddie, he also had this stretch during, I believe that was the early fourth, where he got fouled on like 3 of 4 possessions, including twice on 3-pointers. One was a 4-point play. One was a 3-shot foul on Bielitsa. And we'll talk about the Mavericks offseason very soon. But where, you know, like how Jason Kidd and Harrison, the front office, want to manage this rotation, building it back from a version of scratch, is going to be so important for the Mavericks. And especially when you consider the variable that is Jalen Brunson being a free agent. Jalen Brunson, you know, a very good basketball player, but how do you want to square it? Do you think that there's better chemistry between Doncic and Dinwiddie? Which is better offensively? Which pairing is better defensively? How do you want to make it work? How do you want Luka's rest to work? It's a lot to manage, but it's, generally speaking, assuming Brunson resigns, it's a good problem to have.
Are you waking up with a ton of back pain or shoulder pain or neck pain? The number one reason probably to consider is your mattress. Maybe it's time for a new mattress. And I highly recommend that you check out Helix Sleep, which you can do risk-free with their 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty, depending on the model. And they have 20 unique mattresses, the award-winning Lux, the Ultra Premium Elite Collections. They have Helix Plus, which is designed for big and tall sleepers. Helix Kids, endorsed by child sleep experts. You can take their 2-minute sleep quiz. That's what my wife and I did over 10 years ago now. We still have a number of Helix Sleep mattresses that we've gotten over the years, and we are extremely satisfied with them even now, 10 years later. You might be like, I kind of want to try it out beforehand. Going to the store is not really going to give you any information. You're going to be like, lay down, like, oh, do I take off my shoes? Maybe I should leave my shoes on, but then I got to have my feet hanging off the mattress because I can't leave my shoes on and sleep normally on this mattress. And then you're going to feel awkward laying there after about 30 seconds. Like, you can't determine anything in 30 seconds. So you're going to have to take it home, and you might as well just get it delivered straight to your door and utilize that 100-night trial. And there's never been a better time to use Helix, because they are offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. You can go to helixsleep.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace. We talk about all the time here on the program. That's helixsleep.com/capspace. This is their best offer yet. It won't last long with Helix. Better sleep starts now. Yeah, I think this is a time to get into that Mavs offseason. And there is, of course, the issue of Brunson. They have their first-round pick, which is going to be 26th this year. They owe a future first-round pick to the Knicks, top 10 protected next year. Then they have everything going forward. Their financial situation, assuming they bring back Maxi Kleber, which they'd be fools not to do with his $9 million non-guarantee. Trey Burke probably opts into his $3 million. Other than Brunson, essentially everybody else is under contract. But before even talking about Brunson, they are $8 million over the tax for next year. All that said, and let's assume they bring back Brunson for now. We'll talk in a second about what that'll cost. What do these guys need to get better in an ideal world?
You'd love to see a more dynamic, versatile wing, but I also don't know how much they would actually use that versatility. You know, somebody who, we saw a little bit more of that, of Finney Smith and Bullock, especially Finney Smith actually, doing something with the ball in their hands, you know, like attacking closeouts instead of just taking the open corner three. I think they would be better off with a superior center. If you want to have somebody who fulfills the Dwight Powell role, who is better than Dwight Powell, but that player is probably not in your best five anyway, because I assume your best five is going to involve Maxi Kleber. So maybe that's not a big priority. For me, Dallas is in this weird place where the biggest ways they could upgrade are probably hard for them to do, because it's a larger reorganization. And I don't think they have the resources, especially because they don't really have good young players that they're willing to, that they have to like trade in a deal. They don't have premium draft picks from themselves or from anyone else. So they don't need a ton. You could do a talent. And I had this, I had a really interesting conversation with Rob Mahoney for Real GM Radio that we recorded on Thursday, where we were spitballing ideas of how to break feedback loops. And like, one of the things I talked about in that was somebody who, you know, like running off of makes, which the Warriors did very well at times in this series. And I brought up this idea of how this different theory of the Mavericks, and basically that you could play Luka with somebody who would push the pace, and you just don't ask Luka to do it. And so the idea that you would have, whether it's a bigger guy who grabs and goes, or it's a smaller player who does that. The problem is Dallas has lots of perimeter talent, especially now with the Dinwiddie trade, and that's just not really what any of those guys do. And I don't know that that is a sufficient priority, or that you even have the option to theoretically swap Jalen Brunson or Spencer Dinwiddie for that conceptual player.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think you need to have two ball handlers. I like the way this team is built offensively pretty darn well at this point in time. It might be nice to just get that one knockdown shooter who can like come off of screens, add that element. They kind of have that with Hardaway Jr. He had a disappointing year, and then he broke his foot, and he could be primed maybe with his $19 million for next year. Declining contract though, Danny, goes down to $16 million in his age 32 season.
They're going to need that. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, that would be nice offensively. But as you look at the teams that they're going to have to play, who are you going to have to beat? Well, the Warriors, they'll still be around to some degree, right? As we just think of what could have helped them more in this series. I do think getting more transition would have been able to really help them. They just needed probably some more, just one more depth piece that was actually playable, you know, so they didn't have to go Ntilikina or Josh Green or playing Powell more. You know, I don't think a traditional center would have helped at all in this series, really. So to me, just another piece so that you didn't have to play Finney-Smith and block 42 minutes a game would have been nice. I don't think Hardaway is that. I think Hardaway is too bad defensively to really survive well in a series against the Warriors or, God forbid, the Clippers. And the Nuggets will I mean, that's probably Dallas, Clippers, Nuggets,
Suns.
Warriors, God, Suns, Grizz.
It's gonna be gross.
Now some of those teams are just gonna get injured and fall out of it, but still, that top six is gonna be pretty nasty, you would think, next year.
And I mean, you could even think about, they're a flawed team, but if the Lakers do well enough that they can actually get into the mix, the Mavs would have a lot of trouble containing them.
Yeah, that's probably right. And Finney-Smith, Bullock, those guys are pretty good to guard guards, which is what the teams that they played this year had, but they're not as good to guard forwards if it's LeBron or if it's Kawhi.
There's a parallel here to an extent of what we saw with DeAndre Ayton last year, which is Ayton did very well, but had well-suited matchups for him last year. And like, yeah. And with DFS and Bullock, they got matchups that they can do well in, and the teams that, and I mean, they got all they could eat in some ways offensively in this series. The Warriors were giving up a lot of open corner threes, but as you mentioned, the Clippers in particular, it's like, oh God, who's going to guard Kawhi? Who's going to guard Paul George? And they have all these other kind of ancillary options. And I brought up before how Luka, when the other team had enough offensive weapons that he had to guard somebody, and to Andrew Wiggins' credit, I thought that he did a good job making Luka work as well, it became a real problem. And there aren't that many good secondary ball handlers that aren't point guard sized, and I thought Brunson and Dinwiddie did a fine job defensively in the series, but Dallas is always going to have some points to attack. And then the other thing that freaked me out about Dallas's defense against really good teams over these last couple rounds is their lack of supplemental help rim protection. So the idea of, like, when Kleba was out on the floor and you got by him, and even sometimes when Kleba was standing right there, the Warriors were getting really good stuff. And Golden State challenges defenses in a way that other teams do not, but other teams can challenge that in their own ways. And so who's going to stop Kawhi from getting to a spot? If you play a five-out team, can you prevent the penetration that sinks your defense and concedes good shots? And I don't trust... I think Dallas, I believe they will have a good regular season defense again, but I believe that I will have concerns about them against the best of the best that aren't going away.
Yeah, you make a good point there that maybe while Phoenix and Utah were elite regular season offenses, Dallas's personnel was really better situated to deal with those offenses.
Well, and you could think about Gobert too, where Gobert is a really good basketball player, but he's not a post beast, and he's not even the most efficient player when he gets an offensive rebound. So Dallas didn't bend their defense in a way that other guys could, like Jokic.
Yeah, or if they have to deal with Giannis coming out of the other conference, you know, you make a good point that they really just don't quite have the overall team athleticism that they need. And so maybe upgrading at center would be an interesting idea as we get into some of the things that they could do. They've long been rumored potentially as a Rudy Gobert destination. Now, Utah is another team that we'll talk about soon. My thinking is, what is the deal for Rudy Gobert that actually makes you better next year in your last ditch effort to keep Donovan Mitchell, that maybe just holding on to Gobert and hopefully just playing better is your best option? And then, hey, you know what, if Mitchell wants out, then you trade Gobert at that point also. Maybe you go that route. I'm sure they'll listen on Gobert, but if you're Dallas, all you can really offer, you don't have any young prospects of note, so you're basically offering Hardaway Jr. and Bertans and Powell, some combination of those three guys who make a combined $46 million. And then do you just offer everything you can? Do you offer the holiday trade for Rudy Gobert? He's still not quite on the Luka timeline, right? Like between Luka and Brunson, those guys are young, but also worth noting, Kleba, he's going to be a little bit older at this point. He's 30, and I think his defense has slipped a little bit, even if his offense has gotten a little bit better. And Block is in that range. Finney-Smith is a little bit older also. I think he's 29.
Yeah, so the next year will be his age 29 season.
Thank you, yeah.
And so, next year will be Tim Hardaway Jr.'s age 30 season.
Yeah, I mean, he's on his third contract already.
Yeah. So before we move all the way off of the transition point, I just wanted to get this before I forgot it.
Please.
We got an answer to a question question we hadn't been thinking about a lot during this year, and I wanted to walk through it. So in 1920, Luka Doncic's second year, the Dallas Mavericks played in the half court 82.7% of the time when Luka was on the floor. That was the 11th. That was the 11th percentile, meaning like most frequent. And you ideally you want that to be less frequent because you're getting out in transition, which is more efficient. That went from the 11th percentile and 82.7% to 84.2% last year, third percentile in the NBA. And Dallas had, yet again, second year in a row, had one of the league's best half court offenses in the entire, they were ridiculous.
But we blamed that on the last coach, as Jason likes to call him.
The last coach. And then this year, 84.2% in the half court went to 84.9%, second percentile. We are now at the point where we can have it, and there's yet again a pretty severe differential between when Luka is on the floor and when Luka's off, even though Dallas doesn't have amazing personnel to like run in the other times. We are now at a point where it should be our understanding that Luka Doncic teams are not going to run a lot in transition. And it's frustrating because Luka, when they get in transition, it looks great. Like, and I understand that there are physical limitations to like, not everybody has the cardio or has the bandwidth physically and everything else to push it.
I mean, honestly, though, I think a lot of guys probably don't realize this. And Luka, when he can get any shot that he wants and they're still efficient in the half court, it's like, hey, why make the effort? I still think that just pushing the ball in transition and either getting a layup or an immediate shot out of that takes less effort than driving against a set defense and having to make those explosive movements. Maybe players would disagree with me on that. It's probably a question I should ask. I mean, when I played, I always felt that it's just to just run down the court is...
It's definitely more fun for the support players.
Yeah.
And and that ties in with the idea of could they get that from another person? And it's also another way that, you know, a parallel between Luka and James Harden is that like we reach the point, and Harden is a better transition player than Luka is that partially because he does more hit-head passes.
The only guy I could think of that would fit into that, though, would be like Ben Simmons. And that seems unlikely that he'll ever happen. Although that would be interesting, but I don't think that the Nets would necessarily be interested in that. The Nets will be another interesting Austin.
I'm also not sure that the Mavericks would be, because Dallas is built around half court offense and Ben Simmons in their half court offense creates problems.
Well, yeah, he would just be the screen,
presumably.
I think the avenues generally that they could go to, I'm sure they'll be talked about as a possible Jeremy Grant destination, and they in theory have the ammo to trade for him if they wanted to give up a couple of first round picks or in terms of free agency, we've been through it. TJ Warren, to me, is the only real guy who's available that would be along the lines of what they need. Gary Harris could be an interesting guy for them as well, but he, frankly, would probably have to come off the bench. Maybe he could replace Bullock, although Harris isn't the shooter that Bullock is. You know, Daniel House, Pat Connaughton. We've talked about all these guys already. They're just...
And remember that if the Mavericks retain Jalen Brunson, they would not be able to use the non-taxpayer mid-level because they could not do that and stay under the hard cap.
That's a great point there as well, unless they were to make some other moves to get off of money. So let's talk about Brunson's market now. I mean, it seems like it's going to be in the $20 to $25 million a year range. And do I think he's quite as good as Fred VanVleet? Probably not. Is he better than Malcolm Brogdon at this point? He's definitely, if you look at what his current teammate Spencer Dinwiddie got last offseason, for him to get $18 million a year coming off an injury, I mean, I do think Dinwiddie, maybe his last healthy year at the Nets, was slightly above where Brunson is now. But Brunson, to me, especially offensively, fits in great. And he's so effective in that five-out system, going against small guards, attacking mismatches. He's a pretty good pick-and-roll player as well. I think he needs to improve his outside shooting just as a spot-up guy. But I think he's made strides there, and he's going to continue to do so because he really is an incredible worker. So do they go 4 or 5 years? They can. Mark Cuban said in an interview with Mark Stein on Bally Sports Southwest that they can pay Brunson more than anyone else. If it really gets to that point, then you wonder, but they could go the 5 years. They have full bird rights. They can pay whatever, but it is worth noting if they do bring him back for, let's say, a starting salary of $22 million, that puts you at $28 million into the tax with a $77 million tax payment.
Woo! And the Mavericks, they could reduce that through a couple of, you know, you could think of the smaller stuff. Marquise Chris has a fully guaranteed contract for next year. Maybe you could, and it's not subsidized because it's multi-year. So you could move off of that. Or there are a few things where like a small savings could save Mark Cuban a lot of money.
Burke at $3.3 million. Exactly. Seems very likely to get moved. And maybe that's a, you trade him at the deadline once you paid most of his salary type of thing. They got Boban at $3.5 million, although he's a really good locker room guy. They may not want to move off. They have a lot of fluff on this roster. I mean, maybe another way that they could reduce the tax bill is you throw in a couple of first round picks and you also move off of Hardaway, Bertans, or Paolo, some combination of those guys, pick up a player that you really want to get. And now Bertans, it doesn't exactly have the sexiest remaining contract either at $16 million a year, and Hardaway as well. And Bertans goes out another year after this one, and then it's $5 million guaranteed in 24-25. Paul at least is expiring at $11 million next year. And you know, those are again $46 million in guys who basically are giving you at most 20 minutes a game during the playoffs against a real team. So maybe you can make the trade, have those guys as matching salary, take back less money for this year to reduce the tax bill, but then you're asking teams to eat a lot of money going forward as well, not to mention that you actually want to get a good player back. And so I don't know if they have the ammo to do that. Maybe two first round picks.
Yeah, you know who my target for all of this is? I don't know if they're going to want to make a move, but if they're interested, it's Miles Turner.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Indiana has the capacity to take on some money. They would potentially be interested in some picks. And it's a possibility, and Miles Turner would be a different kind of fit, but I think a really good one with Luka. The idea that he can space the floor as a low usage big, but he also is a capable roller. I think they would get more out of Turner offensively than anybody else has, but he's also a fantastic defensive player. And so if you have Turner, DFS, and Bullock, it's not perfect against everybody. You still have the same flaws we were talking about earlier, but you're cleaning up a lot of the other stuff, and he's a great rim protector. And theoretically, you could potentially do that trade without giving up Kleba. And so then if there are times that Turner is hurt, which has happened before, or that you want to be a little bit more mobile, then you still got Moxie Kleba at least for one more year. And
and also being able to play Kleba and Turner together in some lineups might be nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well. Yeah, Clint Capella could be another possible target for them. It's just a question of which way do you want to lean into. You sure you want to get a center? You know, as you think about it, maybe it does need to be that, because you're always going to have Luka. Luka's always going to be your four man, essentially, on defense. He's not going to give you a lot of rim protection, even if he does get a little bit better, because you need Finney Smith and Bullock chasing guys around on the perimeter, probably the top two opponent threats. So that leaves Luka guarding the other team's four man most of the time. So maybe the only way you really can get good enough on defense is to get that great rim protector. It's just, you know, how not being able to defend with versatility, that's a concern. Do you really want to put money into the center position? And or would you rather go for the Jeremy Grant type? Another possibility I thought of, Danny, would be just trade Tim Hardaway Jr. for Eric Gordon and put in a first round pick. Maybe you could also put another salary into that and get back another semi-useful player from Houston, although I don't know if they even really have any at this point. Maybe just to save some money.
I mean, you could roll the dice on Christian Wood. They'd have bird rights on him.
Yeah, Wood actually has done some switching in his career at times.
Would anything get us back on the Christian Wood hype train faster than him being a center on the Dallas Mavericks?
I think I'm off permanently until he shows he can defend better.
Something else as a piece of context to consider for the Mavericks, and Mark Cuban has made comments about, like, basically we'd be in luxury tax hell for 1 year, and the general substance of that is correct, because the Mavericks have a lot of money coming off, most notably Dwight Powell's 11.1 and Maxi Kleba's 9. Then depending, I'm assuming they're going to keep Reggie Bullock at his partially guaranteed, you know, the full value of that is 10.5. I would rather have him at 10.5 than not. But maybe they could find a home for Bertans. At that point, he'll have only one fully guaranteed season and a couple other things. So it's Dallas could, if they retain Brunson, it looks to me like they're going to be in that circumstance at that point where they're cheaper, but they don't really have the capacity to significantly prove. And so that can draw the bird rights trap, can become a real big problem with Moxie Kleba. Maybe you get into a circumstance where you end up keeping Dwight Powell, who we know they love, and maybe you give him more than you probably should. But ideally if you could do it for a short-term thing. But so Dallas improving from where they are, like maintaining is pretty easy as long as Jalen Brunson would rather be in Dallas than one of these other places for the same money that he doesn't pull a Jeremy Grant. And I don't know Jalen Brunson's heart well enough to know whether that is a correct.
I think even here he has as much of a offensive role as he could want, frankly.
And if he's going to Detroit, then he's playing alongside Cade Cunningham. And I don't think Cade is going to be as heliocentric as Luka, but he's in that ballpark. And the Knicks, that's just an entirely different situation. Maybe he's interested in that. Maybe he's not. But I think Dallas is a pretty good spot to be. And the other lesson for Jalen Brunson, as we've learned throughout the league, whether you were a star or a more modest player, is you can get your money and be somewhere else later on if you really, really want that. And you're not, most players aren't really trapped in a situation that long anymore. So if I were advising Jalen Brunson, assuming the Mavs offer was competitive, I would urge him to take it. And I think their offer is going to be competitive. But so the idea for the Mavs is that it will probably get cheaper, but I think that's more Mark Cuban's money rather than a capacity to him to actually then, okay, we're getting $30 million off our books, so now we get to spend that on another player. And you wonder whether Nico Harrison is going to have the latitude from Cuban, and again, ownership is the biggest competitive advantage in the NBA, to, instead of being in luxury tax hell for 1 year, to sacrifice Mark Cuban's money to make their team better for that time. And whether that's a good player that's making more money than the team wants, or trade, you know, just a, you know, team doesn't want player X and is willing to sacrifice talent to get off it.
And Cuban was one of the biggest luxury tax payers back into the old system, but they've been a cap room team basically since the 2011 CBA. And so I think he's willing to spend, and it's just, you know, is he a $15 million into the tax guy, or is he a like serious tax payment guy? Because as mentioned, they're looking down the barrel. If Jalen Brunson starts at $22 million, they're looking down the barrel of a pretty darn big, you know, kind of more of a Warriors, Nets, Clippers type of tax amount here. And that's just to bring back the guys who are under contract other than Brunson. You know, again, you mentioned it's not, they need to get better. I think for sure, like they beat the Suns, they played great against them. I think this Warriors team honestly is not like that good, and they were pretty outclassed by them in the end, particularly on the defensive end. So Seth made this point, and I think he made it about the Hawks last year too. You don't start next season as the team that got to the Western Conference Finals and try to get better from there. You start next season at zero, just like everyone else, which happens for these surprise teams. It's not an automatic ride, and I think that this team is much better and their success is much more sustainable than last season's Hawks team, to be sure.
And another one like that would be the Portland Trailblazers that made the conference finals. The 19 Blazers, and I think the Mavs have a better foundation than that team too.
That team didn't beat a 64-win team.
No, exactly. Round, right? But there were going to be a couple other strong teams in the West that weren't really present this year. And Dallas's goal, while you have arguably, you know, the guy who we ranked as the, like, in a tier by himself as the best player under 25, best prospect in the league.
Under 23.
23, sorry.
23 and under, we should say.
23 and under, is you want to make the most of that window. And there are a lot of different elements in play there, but you have Luka Doncic, and you don't know how long, you know, he's under contract for a while, but you don't know how long the peak, when the peak of his powers is going to be and everything else. And so it's a lot for this front office to consider, to take in, and they don't really have much margin for error here. Like, if you make another bet and that doesn't pan out, and like, you could argue this with Tim Hardaway Jr., like, and I've been wrong on a lot of these before, of like, for example, you brought up the D'Angelo Russell trade, and part of the reason why I didn't like that from the Warriors' perspective was I thought other teams were going to see that he turned into a pumpkin fast enough that they wouldn't be able to trade him. It ended up being that Gerson Rosas didn't, and they moved him quickly enough and got Andrew Wiggins, and Andrew Wiggins has worked out very well. Tim Hardaway Jr., partially due to the injury, which just sucks for him and for the Mavericks.
Yeah. And also his poor play before as well.
Yes, but the injury is in many ways more relevant, because that will scare off some of the teams that might not have cared about the poor play. And so, but if they, you know, if they make another bet that doesn't work out, whether that's due to misevaluation or a cruel twist of fate, it gets a lot harder. And they're in a good place. They're in a better place than I anticipated. anticipated. The Reggie Bullock addition worked out well. And what I would say is I brought up the Blazers and I said that, you know, and this team has a better foundation and Luka is at a different point in his career than Dame. But some of the concerns with that team of like, how do you get better and what resources are you going to bring to bear? And like, the timeline of the timetable of contention, it's not as clear cut positive for Dallas as it would be in other cases, in part because they just don't have young talent.
Yeah, and certainly there are guys, Dinwiddie, Brunson, Finney Smith, Lucas is still doing better. Like, we think more of these players than we did back when every single Spotify Live had a question of what the hell do the Mavs do? But there's a reason that that question was still asked. I do think they still need a talent upgrade to get to an NBA championship. Also worth noting before we finish up on them, they do have a $10.9 million trade exception from the Josh Richardson trade. However, that expires on June 27th, and so they really would have to make a move at the draft that would be legal to do at the draft. You couldn't agree at the draft and then consummate it after the new league year. And now with they could certainly bring a guy in to that trade exception and then make another move later.
Yeah, and so that would have to be a player like not on an expiring contract and a few other constraints.
Yeah, or even roll that trade exception over if they just take in a $10 million player and send out a $10 million player. You could then just basically extend that trade exception into next year. But that could be useful, certainly, in making some deals. And in any deal that they make, maybe they could preserve some of that into a new exception that could work throughout the season for them if they wanted to make more moves. But in general, I don't see them just taking on $10 million extra dollars. That doesn't seem particularly likely to me at this point in time, given where their tax situation already is. Let's get some news. Oh, we should also mention too for the Mavs, Frank Ntilikina, $2 million non-guaranteed for next year, guaranteed date July 4th. Guessing they probably just keep him.
I'd keep him,
and if he could just make a few more shots, which he did, he made a couple in this Warriors game, but he still wasn't getting guarded. He could be a valuable defensive player. He was useful in that Sun series.
Hopefully they can get a viable, even ideally a viable 16 game rotation player from one of Ntilikina, Sterling Brown, and Josh Green next year.
Yeah, that would be nice. And it starts with those guys being able to reliably hit shots.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So we're starting to get some rumblings here, Danny. Could just be smoke, could just be posturing for guys who want to get paid in their current environments are going to be free agents. But Christian Winfield of the New York Daily News covers the Nets. I talked about this a lot with Hollinger today, but I wanted to at least bring it up with you. He had an article with a couple interesting things. Number one, he said, a source familiar with the inner workings of the Nets roster last summer told me that James Harden would leave Brooklyn, followed by Kyrie Irving, and then ultimately Kevin Durant. According to multiple sources, Durant and the Nets front office have not spoken since they were swept out of the first round. And perhaps most importantly, the Nets are hesitant, according to a source familiar with the Nets thought process, and in fact, outright unwilling to give Kyrie Irving a long-term deal.
Oh boy, the Nets functional problem here, if they, you know, if there is a conscious uncoupling from Kyrie Irving, is how do they do that in any way, shape, or form that makes them a still viable team moving forward?
And why, if they don't have Kyrie Irving or a talent who is commensurate with him on the roster, Kevin Durant has no reason to stay there.
No reason whatsoever. And Kyrie, challenging person, flawed player at times, still incredibly talented. And they got into the Kyrie Irving business a few years ago. Kyrie Irving, who has left other successful situations, and that was for whether that's Cleveland or Boston, and more power to him if that's what he wants to do. But the other complicator here is something that we talked about a lot in when we were doing kind of like fake negotiations with DeAndre Ayton signed in trades, which is, why would another team, let's say there's a team that is interested in Kyrie Irving, why would they give up significant assets to pay him market value. And what in the world is market value for Kyrie Irving? We would have to see.
One thing that was floated by Jake Fisher was that maybe he could just sign with one of these other teams that have space, with the idea that they would just eventually trade him and that's how he could get his money or something.
Sure,
but he's a good citizen. That seems too attenuated to me.
It does seem attenuated. That seems like generating leverage where very little exists. And but so, like, let's say a team was interested in, I don't know, like Orlando. Let's say the Orlando Magic were interested in Kyrie Irving. What are they going to give Brooklyn? I mean, they could even do something with cap space. But like, from Brooklyn's perspective, it's you run into the same problem that, like, incidentally, that the Warriors tried to do, and they actually resolved better than we anticipated with Kevin Durant, which is you can't let the guy go for nothing because you have to the salary slot and talent and everything else. But it's not like Orlando is going to give up a ton of resources to pay Kyrie Irving, and so you might get something back, but you're not going to do anything else. So it's a really, really messed up situation. I saw this originally on NBA Reddit, but I just want to the first part of it. But I thought you'd enjoy this. Theoretically, and I don't think it would happen this quickly, what team has the most resources theoretically to send to Brooklyn in a Kevin Durant trade?
Oh my God, Memphis Grizzlies, Golden State Warriors,
the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the second most you could argue is the Golden State Warriors. So,
well, as a place he would actually like to go, fuck, maybe he would rather just go back to OKC. I don't think so. I think he's like too urbane at this point for OKC.
I mean, the question of if Kevin Durant wants out, what circumstance, like what the terms of that would be, are mind boggling, and I don't know that I'm mentally capable of processing that just yet. I also don't think it would happen that quickly. But if Kyrie Irving signs somewhere else, maybe it does. And oof, does that get into some wild stuff? And then, I mean, so you have that circumstance. And then I thought where you're going with the, like, you hear the murmurs and inklings is like, how do we want to address the murmurs coming out of things with Zach LaVine? And Zach LaVine, in many ways, this parallels the previous collective bargaining agreement where, because, and I'm still so frustrated by this, the CBA is still massively screwed up for high-level players that don't make all NBA teams. He's hitting unrestricted free agency for the first time, and the Chicago Bulls are definitely interested in retaining him. It seems like Zach LaVine is going to give them a fair shot, but he's getting interest from other teams. It seems like he's interested. And so the question becomes, as we speculated for all those years when these guys who were, you know, like Kevin Durant and all these others were hitting unrestricted free agency on their third contracts, is this genuine interest? Is this wanting something else? Or is this just, I get to be wooed for the first time since I was a college recruit and I'm going to enjoy it?
So I think there's a number of things going on here, and it's difficult to parse out what it is necessarily. It seemed like when things were going well there, he was widely assumed to be returning to the Bulls. However, he underwent this surgery, which is a quote-unquote cleanup. Casey Johnson reported that, or I'm sorry, actually this is Jake Fisher. LaVine told Confidence his knee at times feels like it has loose cartilage. An MRI taken in January showed no structural damage. I mean, okay. Does he still have no structural damage after playing on it for 3.5 months after that? And so perhaps related to that, this knee issue where he just had surgery, we didn't, of course, get any kind of a real reporting on what it was. Casey Johnson says there's speculation from rival executives whether or not the Bulls will extend LaVine the full maximum contract. And that would be, since he didn't make All-NBA, still a rather healthy five-year, $212.3 million deal, which perhaps, and maybe they could do it with an exclusion on his knee, or maybe they could try to get a non-guarantee in the last year. LaVine is quite young still. He's 27 as an unrestricted free agent with 8 years of experience. And assuming this knee thing is okay, it's different offering a 27-year-old that contract versus a 29-year-old. Also, though, Zach LaVine is maybe a top 30 player in the NBA, maybe top 25. Maybe a better way to say that is the 25th, 30th best player in the NBA, something like that, when you consider his defense. And maybe there's the potential to get better. I think he's played at a slightly higher level than that at times when he's been healthy the last 2 years, but there's a lot of good scoring guards in this league. And so maybe this is all coming from the Bulls are not going to use their advantage in years and annual raises. And once you get to that, a four-year deal becomes a little more palatable. And maybe there are some other teams that are clearly interested in him at that price. He's been linked to the Spurs now, the Blazers, the Lakers, although I don't really know how that would happen, the Mavs, the Hawks. So how much of this is posturing? But it is worth noting there are not many guys who have done the full wine and dine thing and return. Like Carmelo Anthony in 2014, probably wishes he hadn't, frankly. And a few others come to mind, but generally when these things get done, they're just done without this, oh, I'm going to fly to the city and do the meeting, or we're going to have a parade of teams going in and out. It sounds like that's what they are planning on doing as of this point.
Speaking of wined and dined, the biggest shift that has happened off the court since the last time we did news is involving front office, and that is Tim Connelly leaving the confines of the Denver Nuggets to go to the Minnesota Timberwolves. And this had been, you know, the discussions between those, between Connelly and the Wolves have we brought up before, but he actually signed it. And compensation is, of course, a significant part of this. The reporting on this is that it looks like Connelly is going to make about twice as much as he was with Denver. And there's this potential for an ownership stake, which is fascinating. And I want to, I don't think this isn't going to be a circumstance where we probably get to see the actual contract, but this is a significant move for the Minnesota Timberwolves, who brought in somebody over Sachin Gupta, who, I mean, well regarded within the league. It sounds like they're going to work together, though that is far from assured as far as I can tell. And so this is like ownership being serious, ownership being the biggest competitive advantage. And we've talked a little bit previously about like, where does Tim Connelly fit within the like general manager rankings? But from Minnesota's perspective, just being in the room, getting somebody and having the difference be the money that you offer is a huge step for the franchise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just beefing up their scouting a little bit more, or as they try to build around Anthony Edwards, as they decide whether they're going to extend Karl-Anthony Towns now, who did make all NBA, so is now eligible for the Supermax. We'll have to talk a little bit more about the all NBA consequences in a second. I talked about this very extensively with John. He had some original reporting that the reason why Denver wasn't able to get compensation was that Connelly actually had it in his contract that if he wanted to leave, that Denver couldn't ask for compensation, which presumably was the result of Denver just preferring to leave that in there rather than just pay him more and have an actual normal executive contract that would require compensation for a lateral move, which this would be for president of basketball operations to the
great
title.
Great negotiations by one Tim Connelly.
Yeah, it bodes well for how well he's going to do for... He actually did a much better job of negotiating his own contract with Denver ownership than he did a few of these extensions. But overall, Connelly, of course, has done a good job. And well, I don't know if he would be in my personal top five GMs, which is what Minnesota was talking about seeking. I think he was the best established executive that they could get given this contract situation with Denver, and has objectively as good an argument as a lot of guys would for top five. So I think outside of that top tier of maybe three or four executives, I think he's firmly within that next tier by any objective standard. So obviously Denver cheaped out. Minnesota has the commitment here. Mark Laurie is very into getting the best people that he can and paying top dollar for executive talent. He's done so here. If you want to hear more of my thoughts on that and John's, which are probably even more useful, I recommend listening to that. So this doesn't necessarily affect Denver right now. Their team is kind of built at the moment, but it's just another example of that organization, which doesn't have a practice facility and was very, very late to getting a G League team and has always operated with a skeleton staff. It's another instance of them cheaping out, and perhaps that's because it's zero sum and they know they have to pay the luxury tax next year, or... maybe they'll find a way out of the old tax.
Or reduce their bill. I mean, we've seen the Kroenkes take basically every step possible to pay as little as they can. And so it seems like they're promoting from within with Calvin Booth. And again, we have to see on terms of which Nuggets personnel joins Connelly and who else. There's been some speculation on that. I'll wait until we actually see before we have a ruling on that. And then, yeah, I mean, how much are they actually willing to spend and for how long? Because
yeah, now Mike Singer did report that Nikola Jokic's desire to sign the Supermax extension that he will no doubt be offered is undiminished by this. But I would certainly be looking for at least some commitments here that they are going to spend significantly after this latest cheaping out. But, you know, when you own Walmart, it's tough to really, you know, maybe they could increase prices on paper towels to $1.73 a roll instead of $1.72 or something. I don't know. The Lakers. there's been a lot of reporting, and I don't think that this organization is smart enough to just be posturing with this, these leaks, that the Lakers don't want to include a first to trade Russell Westbrook. And Jovan Bua wrote an impassioned plea, which if I covered the team and didn't want to have to watch this terrible basketball, I would probably be pretty passionate about it too. But I think what's lost in this whole idea of trading Russ, I mean, number one, you know, he's probably overpaid by $25 million minimum based on his production next year. So just normally it's been about $20 million in dead salary equals one first round pick. Maybe that's up to like 25 now with inflation, but still. And then you also have to throw in, it's not only just getting rid of Russell Westbrook, it's actually getting back players who can play for him as well. And that takes value. So to me, if you could trade Russell Westbrook for, I don't know, three pretty good rotation guys to put around LeBron and AD, ha ha ha, but players of that caliber, I mean, in terms of just the other team's perspective, yeah, it's going to take a first round pick to do that. Maybe if you unprotect that 2027 pick, I might be interested, just because it's unprotected or extremely lightly protected. It's not just some late first round pick, and so that's why it's worth it to me. But yeah, like, I mean, maybe it's just the cost to move him is going to be so prohibitive that they just want to get high on their own supply and make the exact same mistake they made last year and say, oh, well, it's Frank Vogel's fault and a new coach is really going to find a way to use Russell Westbrook. No, he's actually just not good. Not only is he a bad fit, but he's just not good. Like, that's the bigger problem. Like, if he were still a good version of Russell Westbrook, like, they could have made it work last year. He's just not good anymore, though. So I think that's the biggest reason they need to move on from him, even more so than, oh, does he have the ball? Does he not have the ball? Where is he standing, etc.?
Yep, I echo all of that. From Jake Fisher's piece, the current expectation is that both Bradley Beal and Donovan Mitchell will stay in their respective teams this summer, and the Hawks could potentially make a strong offer. Jake talks about this idea that Atlanta could be looking for a shakeup and they have things that they can offer. And again, as is often the case, it's just who is going to shake loose. And another player who could potentially shake loose, we've talked about when we did the Suns offseason preview, you know, DeAndre Ayton.
Yeah, there's still plenty of stuff out there with this idea that Ayton will have max offers and that the Suns may not match those. Fisher said three teams are most often linked by league personnel.
Though, you know who would most want it out there that the Suns might not match a max offer sheet?
Yeah,
DeAndre Ayton.
Yeah, right. Because Bill Duffy is his agent, right?
I believe so.
Yeah,
yes.
So, yeah, he had a nice little 2018 draft, Bill Duffy. So Atlanta, Detroit, and Portland as the most often cited potential suitors. Detroit and Portland do have the ammo probably to get to a max offer or pretty darn close to it if they wanted to. Ultimately, what it boils down to me, though, is just Phoenix just can't lose him for nothing. They just can't. They have to match to me. And yeah, you know what? He might have disappointed this year. But what other path do you have, especially as Chris Paul ages, than to hope that DeAndre Ayton can become a real offensive star? And he has improved quite a bit over his career. And obviously that Mikal Bridges can get a little better on offense and that Devin Booker can really become a top 10 player. That's your path to continued relevance as Chris Paul slows down. So to me, as much as I'm probably lower on DeAndre Ayton than a lot of people, but to me, if the Suns didn't match an offer sheet, it would be a grave mistake, even if he is overpaid, because they're just never going to get that type of talent in the door anymore.
And like we brought up with the Mavs earlier, losing DeAndre Ayton does not open the door for somebody else. It's not like you get another $30 million this year or next to just trade for somebody or sign somebody. Nope, that's not the way this works. The NBA has a soft cap and it makes it so that you get in these circumstances. To me, even if you don't want DeAndre Ayton on the team long term, unless a team makes a strong offer in the immediate, retain him, matching or through a new contract, and then it's more plausible to find something down the line should it not work out, and you also get a lot more information. And speaking of more information, with the All-NBA teams coming out, Devin Booker and Karl-Anthony Towns made All-NBA teams, and that makes them eligible for Supermax extensions, and for those guys, that would put them into the 35% threshold. But, interestingly, both Booker and Towns have two more remaining years, 22-23 and 23 23-24 on their current contracts. So what this would do is it would add 4 new years starting in 24. And that, you know, roughly, it depends on where the cap is at that point. 4 years, $211 million in new money. We've discussed when we did the Suns breakdown that we think Phoenix should offer that and Devin Booker should accept it. Carl Anthony Towns, that's a ton of money. If Minnesota offers it, it would be awfully, awfully hard to turn down, even if their path to being a championship team is pretty faint and you could always make your way out another way. As Minnesota, do you offer that?
Now, keep in mind, they don't have to offer the full amount, although we haven't really seen that happen yet. They could, it could start as little as 30% of the salary cap. It could decline potentially. There could be non-guarantees, etc. It's been a tough decision for Tim Connelly. I mean, given Connelly's history in terms of rewarding players and retaining players, you have to imagine that that offer will just be made, and to keep Carl Anthony Towns. And again, you would think for the next couple of years, at least, he'll be playing at a level commensurate with his salary. So he would at least be tradable, and people kind of just forget about those next few years of the contract if he's playing at a level that's worth his salary that year. So I think ultimately I would try to negotiate some on that. That's just not generally the way things work. And, you know, I would have still had Carl Anthony Towns below Rudy Gobert, but still close as my All-NBA third team center. He's a very good player. Also, though, you could see a few of his flaws in the playoffs with the fouls, and also just he doesn't dominate the ball the same way that Embiid and Jokic do, even if he has more gravity on the outside due to his shooting. Other All-NBA news, Trae Young makes All-NBA third team along with Chris Paul in the backcourt, and with that, Trae Young is going to make the Hawks finances a little bit more difficult. He now qualifies for an extra $6 million on his extension. All he had to get was third team, and it rises to 30% of the cap, and he's worth that, but that takes away $6 million in extra spending capacity for the Hawks over these next few years. In fact, I will update my sheet right now to reflect that. There we go. So that makes the Hawks finances a little more interesting. We'll talk about that in a future episode. Anything else you wanted to hit on for All-NBA?
No, I think that's all we need to do.
Devin Booker making first team All-NBA would not have been something that I had, it's probably not relevant at this point.
Yeah. So I mean, Devin Booker, you could go back and listen to our awards. Anything that was different than what we had, we disagree with.
Yes, thank you. That's good. So Pascal Siakam made All-NBA third team, Pascal NBA, and DeRozan did make it at forward on second team. KD, despite the not playing that many games, made it as well. Steph and Ja on second team guards, Luka and Booker. First team guards, Giannis and Tatum, first team forwards, and of course, Jokic at center. And I think that's it.
Nope.
Except for one more thing that we need to discuss, and that is a congratulations to our yearly podcast guest, Mike Schmitz of First Draft Express, then ESPN. He's hired by the Portland Trailblazers as assistant GM, and we normally wouldn't talk about assistant GM, but since I know Mike well and he's been a friend of the program, I just want to congratulate him on his hard work, and I think he'll be a great asset to the Blazers organization. Obviously knows a lot of these young players with some of the interviews that he does, and of course his scouting and pounding the pavement. He knows as much about all the players at the grassroots levels as much as you possibly can, but also I think he has a great understanding of modern basketball and what wins in modern basketball, which I think a lot of scouts, both in the media and for teams, don't really have. And so both the ability to evaluate players and what are they now and how can they develop, and then to also say, hey, how valuable are these skills that we believe are going to develop in the current league ecosystem? I think that's a great combination of skill sets, and we're gonna miss him on this show. I'll try to get him on. He's still gonna work at ESPN through the draft. I'm guessing he probably isn't gonna be able to come on since he's gonna be a little busy, but I will invite him nonetheless. But regardless of whether he can come on or not, congratulations, richly deserved there.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I have an immense amount of respect for Mike and the way that he has his career arc is so, first of all, it is affirming of his skills and work ethic and emotional intelligence. I think that's something that shines through in the interviews that he does with players. But to go from, you know, being a video coordinator for the Bakersfield Jam to the excellent work that he did on Draft Express to them getting picked up by ESPN, it is thrilling to see somebody make those steps. And I don't think this is the end of those steps. I think this is another one on the road. And Schmitz is there are always these like kind of exceptions, like exceptions that prove the rule, where it's like he has the tools to do the next thing really, really well. I don't think this is a Peter Principle situation in the slightest. And I'm excited to see that. I am, from a selfish perspective, deeply disappointed to lose, just as I was to lose those Draft Express videos. He shifted into something else that was really cool when once they got to ESPN. But losing all of that in the public domain is going to make our lives harder, but it's going to be, I'm assuming it is a great decision for him because he's choosing to make it. And I'm also very encouraged for the Portland Trailblazers, and Joe Cronin gets to add this kind of talent. And it's thrilling to see people that you know and that you've known for years that have earned this to get the opportunity, because we know how few jobs there are and I could not be more happy for Mike Schmitz for this.
All right, well, that will do it for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you're listening on the free pod, I encourage you to give Dunked On Prime a try. I also encourage you to watch with Danny and me on Playback. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. You just sign in with your cable provider. It's all in the window. If you're an International League Pass person, it works there as well. You don't have to sync up anymore. You can just watch the game, get the crowd noise in the background, adjust the volume between our commentary and the background noise. It's a great product. I hope you will join us there. We'll do, of course, game 6 of Celtics Heat, and then all of the road games in the finals that are not, of course, in San Francisco. And then finally, too, if you've been thinking about doing Dunked On Prime, but you're not in a great economic situation, at the top of my pinned tweets at Nate Duncan NBA, we do offer a product for Dunked On Prime for those who are not in a great financial position right now. You can find out more details about that in the letter that is my pinned tweet right now. So I hope you will check out one of our products as we get into our favorite times of year, the NBA Finals, going into the draft, and then free agency. We'll talk to you all soon.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.